The views and opinions of this podcast are solely those of the creators and do not reflect any streaming service or platform. This podcast contains strong language and contrarian viewpoints that may be objectional to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
And welcome to Three Geeks in a Microphone podcast. I'm Dean.
I'm Art.
I'm Russ.
And today we are going to be discussing the 79 classic Alien. So, gentlemen, when was the first time you ever saw this?
I think I saw for the first time shortly after the second one came out, but just before the second one came out on VHS.
Okay.
And then I became obsessed with the film, mostly because it made my younger sister throw up. We're eating, watching the movie and drinking Pepsi, and man, she puked everywhere.
Wow. It's a visceral reaction. Russ?
I probably saw this way back in my childhood, off and on. I don't think I watched the whole thing all the way through until maybe the late 80s. But it was one that I remember because I had older siblings. My brother was 15 years older, so he would do the whole rent the VCR and pick out movies, you know, and that thing. And I remember it was one of them. And I'd watch it, and then I would be told to close my eyes or something like that, which then, of course, I'd leave my eyes open so I could watch. But, you know, when you're like, what was I, probably about five or six or something, real young. So it was mostly just vague memories of it. It wasn't until I watched it all the way through. And then I was like, wow, this is pretty good.
Well, I know I first heard about it from a story from my mom. My cousin was out from California visiting my grandma, and he wanted to see this new movie, Alien. So my mom took it. And they saw it in the theater in 1979. And mom was just blown away by what she saw on the screen. That was not what she was expecting for a sci-fi movie. And that's when I first heard about it. And I probably didn't see it until mid-80s, I guess. And then once I saw it and then saw Aliens, I was hooked. Although, unfortunately, the sequels kind of go downhill after Aliens, but I digress. Yeah, it's probably, I don't know, mid to late 80s was the first time I saw it. And I will fully admit, this movie, I wouldn't say it scared the hell out of me, but I definitely had this feeling of dread through the entire movie. So, but let's, anything else from your initial reaction to when you saw it? Or
yeah, the image that's behind me, I was completely obsessed with. I wanted to know the story of that creature. Whatever.
Space jockey.
Yeah, whatever the fuck. Well, we didn't know. Nobody knew that that's what it was actually called back then, because they didn't actually name it in the film.
No,
but I and seeing it on VHS and then later on RCA Selectivision, the image was kind of grainy, so you couldn't really make out what it was. But damn, did I want to know what the hell that was.
Mm-hmm. H.R. Giger for you.
Yeah,
I guess we should start by, I guess, some of the background, if you want. Maybe do a little different today, start kind of the background of the movie.
All right.
It was written by, the screenplay was written by a guy named Dan O'Bannon, who he was working on I can never pronounce his name. He was a French filmmaker. This guy had gotten the rights to Dune from Frank Herbert and was going to do this insane version of Dune with Salvador Dali in the cast. And it was just utterly insane. And O'Bannon was brought in to write the script. Well, it fell apart in Paris. So he ended up flying back to the States. He didn't have a job at the time. And he moved in with a friend of his, another screenwriter. And in the course of about 4 months, he wrote, well, both of them together wrote the script that became Alien. They started chopping it around and no one really liked it. And Fox took a look at it. They said, okay, this is interesting. We like it. We'll do it for a $2 million budget. And then Ridley Scott got wind of it, loved the script. And as soon as he became interested in it, the budget jumped up to $10 million. Sigourney Weaver got on board and the budget went up again. One of the things O'Bannon insisted on was bringing Giger on board to do the artwork and the artwork and creature design. Bannon is an interesting guy. He grew up in rural Missouri on a 24-acre farm, and he didn't even have a phone until he was 10 years old. Like, there was no library in town. His mom would send for like boxes of books for him. He would read the books and then send them back. But his mom did not like sci-fi. So any sci-fi he had to sneak in to read. And he had this really, well, his dad owned, you ever see those roadside attractions? Like, you know, the mystery spot where you're standing there and like the room's all off kilter. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah. Oregon's full of them.
His dad owned one of those. That's how they made income. And his dad even faked a UFO landing. O'Bannon helped write press releases to get press out for this event, which of course never took place. But he was terrified of bugs. They had massive locust infestations and cicada awakenings in Missouri. And when he was younger, he wrote a screenplay called They Bite. It was the first major screenplay he would write. And a lot of the bones of what Alien became is in this screenplay. So he's been doing this since he was a kid. It was about a cicada-like creature that was coming up from the underground after millions of years, and it starts killing off an encampment of people one by one and evolving as it does. So he's had this idea in his head since he was a kid. He wrote the script and his buddy helped flesh it out. Like I said, they took it to Fox. We got what we got. So I guess let's get into it. So there's some background on O'Bannon. Anyone else have anything they want to bring up about the background, or
other than Ripley? Sigourney Weaver playing Ripley was originally slated to be a man, like you'd mentioned.
Yes.
But Sigourney Weaver wasn't the original first choice either. That was Meryl Streep, which would have made it kind of a completely different kind of movie. But
oh, definitely.
Sigourney Weaver, by far, I think, was a better choice. Not because that's how everybody remembers the movie. I just think she was a better actress.
Mm.
And fit the...
Yeah.
If you ever read the book by Alan Dean Foster that was essentially written at the same time the film was being made, she, I think, would have... She physically brought the look to Ripley to life better than I think Meryl Streep would have.
Yeah, Sigourney Weaver just has like a still feminine but very badass vibe about her that just seems like this is a what would you say,
resting bitch face?
Well, there's that, but it's kind of like attractive, but yet you know that if you try to be like a creeper to her, she'd kick the shit out of you.
Yeah.
Where Meryl Streep would have been like, stop it. You know, and
well, I'll get into this later, but I don't know, the general consensus about Alien and aliens is in Alien, Ripley is portrayed as this badass feminist, you know, hero. You know, she's a woman, she can kick ass, but if you actually go watch the movie itself, first of all, like Art said, literally the only thing changed in the part was the name.
Right.
It was like John Ripley, and then they just changed the first name to Ellen. Nothing else changed. Not even the dialogue changed. So to say that she's some type of a feminist hero in this movie is ridiculous, because if you watch, she's just fucking lucky.
Oh, yeah.
She's just completely lucky. Now, I would make the argument in Aliens, the sequel, yes, she is this badass female hero. I can totally get on board with that, but not with Alien.
Well, I kind of look at it like kind of the Sarah Connor thing. I mean, granted, too, in the comic books, Alien, Predator, and Terminator, and RoboCop are all in the same universe.
But RoboCop, that I didn't know.
Well, there's been crossovers. Let me rephrase that. But anyway, okay. She's very much like Sarah Connor, where she starts out as a normal person, put into an extreme situation, and evolves into a badass.
Right.
Yeah, and not meaning to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's definitely luck, but the fact that she has what evolves into that badass into the next, aliens, it's like it's inside her already, and given it was just luck, but it was slowly hatching throughout the first movie. It's luck, but if it was like Meryl Streep type, she would have probably just like curled up in a ball and let the alien get her. It's like, instead, she keeps trying and she keeps going forward, even though it's luck, but she's not giving up. And the same thing, it would have been a man, too. You'd have other, there's guys that would curl up in the ball and cry, or they would, and the character, if it would have been John, it would have been the same thing. He would have been just lucky, probably been more timid at the start, but by the end of it, you see something change inside of them that survival kicks in instead of, what they call it, fight or flight.
Fight or flight. Mm-hmm.
And it's, and they couldn't flight. So they probably would have ended up just kind of male or female. They could have gone either into a curled up fetal position and died or become a badass.
Well, is that true? Because, think about it. In essence, they did flight because they knew the alien was afraid of fire. They had the gear, the flamethrowers, to kill it, but they decided to leave the ship anyhow. Why didn't she just hunt it down and kill it? So in the end, she did flee.
Yeah,
but I mean, it makes sense. I mean, they already established by that point these creatures bleed acid,
right?
So if you were to shoot it,
you destroy your ship.
Yeah, you end up blowing a hole in your own ship. I mean, there's only so much you could do. Really, blowing it out the airlock is really your only choice. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like you can get out the ship. I mean, I guess maybe my opinion's a little bit different because, like on a submarine, if you have a fire and you're in the middle of the ocean, or if the kitchen catches on fire, if the cruise mess or the galley catches on fire, you're not ordering a fucking pizza.
Right.
Okay. There's nowhere to go. You're in the ocean. With them, they were in space. It's not like they were going to stand outside and call AAA and wait for a tow truck to come get their asses.
And in a way, they had to do both. They had to fight and flight in order to survive. So it's kind of like flighting is part of fighting.
Okay, I can see it that way. But the other thing I noticed, I mean, I know we haven't delved into the movie yet, but maybe it's a plot hole, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
At one point, Dallas says, played by Tom Skerritt, probably one of the coolest roles I've ever seen him in. When they first go down, I always forget the number. What is it? LV-429?
426.
426. When they're going onto the surface of the planet, he says to him, break out the weapons. Okay, we don't see any weapons, but we assume they're armed. But when they come back to the ship, they're now trying to cobble together weapons to fight it. So where are the weapons that they broke out when they went down to onto the surface?
Right.
That totally jumped out at me when I watched it the other day. I'm like, wait a minute. If they have weapons, why don't they use them?
I actually, when I was watching it, I kind of thought about that too. But at the same time, it was like, okay, well, they can shock it without making it bleed. They could potentially burn it and drive it someplace. to blow it out an airlock, but if they shoot it, it's just going to leak acidic blood everywhere and put a hole in the ship. In fact, that was kind of what they talked about, you know, when Ash tried to cut the finger off of the mm-hmm. face hugger and it burned through the hull. They thought it was going to burn all the way through the ship.
It goes down what, three decks?
Yeah, three or four.
So I don't know. So I don't know. Do you want to start from the beginning and kind of go from there?
If I mean, we kind of have already, but okay. Yeah, we can. Or I mean, we just keep going the way we are. It's
all right. The interesting thing I noticed is there is literally no dialogue or human or real interaction for almost the first 45 minutes of the movie. The first 20 minutes alone, there's nothing there. I mean, think about the opening shot. You see the camera going through and you see the ship empty. It's completely empty.
Yeah, and you see the reflections of the monitors on the emergency helmets.
Mm-hmm. And it's when they get the transmission from the alien vessel or whatever. Now, in the original script, it wasn't a ship. It was a temple complex on the planet in the original script. That was changed. I don't remember if I remember why it was changed. But in the original script, they find a pyramid that is projecting this signal. I guess it makes more sense for a ship, but and have you guys ever heard of something called cassette futurism?
Well, there's a YouTube channel with that name.
Yeah, it's an aesthetic, if you will,
right.
That it's what would happen if we went into the future, but our technology was locked in the 80s. Everything has switches. There's big monitors. There's no touch screens. This movie is a lot of times held up as a perfect example of cassette futurism.
Yeah, but there were other examples. I mean, the original Star Trek, which predated this by like, what, 15 years?
Sure.
At least was pretty much the same way. I mean, if you looked at the bridge of the Enterprise, they had slider switches and things like that. So, I mean, this really, and even the movie Soylent Green was another good example of being time locked in a sense.
Right. This is time, or the way they put this is it's time locked in the late 70s, early 80s. Going into the future, because you have discs. And what's funny is if you compare it to the newer movies like Prometheus, that is supposed to take place years before this one, the tech is more futuristic than what you see here.
Yeah, and that's kind of a continuity issue with me, because like even Star Trek had that issue where, like, if you watched Enterprise, which was supposed to predate the original series by 80 years,
right?
They had the same problem where the technology on the bridge of the NX-01 was looked way advanced visually compared to what was on Kirk's Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Well, same thing even happens with the Star Wars prequels. You know, the ships look more aerodynamic, more
sleek.
Yeah, where
sure, I gotcha. I mean, it's I just find it funny that you would think they would try to keep it in line with what came before if they're going backwards in time, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's like a continuity issue with a lot of things, and it's actually visually frustrating to watch at times.
But I agree. I love the cassette futurism aesthetic. I guess another big one that the community likes to talk about is, I didn't see it all the way through, but do any of you guys watch Loki?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess there's a building in Loki that is like oozes cassette futurism.
Yeah.
So I've seen pictures and screenshots. I haven't watched the show myself, but I digress. The opening shot, is it just me or does the ship itself just look weird? it's,
well, I mean, the model for it was kitbashed, but it was meant to be like a mining, think of it like an intergalactic semi essentially, but it carried like mining equipment. They were like an asteroid mining ship. So if you had to put it like a whole, I mean, it makes, in some ways visually, it kind of makes sense. It has a somewhat logical layout to it because a lot of it was supposed to be carrying ore from an asteroid mine or a space mine of some kind. And in a lot of ways, I mean, this movie kind of makes, or starts kind of a trend, that you kind of see in Leviathan and Deep Star Six, or not Deep Star Six. The hell is that movie? It's Deep Something Six.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. What is it?
But anyway, the thing where you've got people in a remote area having to deal with some kind of an entity, and there's no help anywhere around them really, but it's like a diverse crew of some kind, you know, trapped either under the ocean, and even, and it even kind of carried out a little bit in the movie The Abyss.
I can totally see that. So, and the other thing, I believe it was a cinematographer on this, he had previously worked on 2001 A Space Odyssey, and 2001 was shown as to be hyper, at least as far as space travel goes, hyper realistic. And in this, you have Harry Dean Stanton walking into this large room with chains coming down from the ceiling before he gets eaten, and there's water dripping, it's almost raining in this room. This is something we would not have, we'd never seen before in a space movie before, in everything is like really sterile, you know what I mean? Even in Star Trek, I don't think you would see like water or anything inside the ship.
No, it was supposed to be like condensation,
right?
Because the size of the inside of that, like if you look around in that room actually had like bulldozer type, like heavy equipment for mining in it, and then storage containers,
and everything was rusty.
Yeah. So I mean, it makes logical sense. You know, I mean, people perspire, and you've got pipes and things like coolant pipes, things like that, sweating, you know, like your toilet does sometimes, you know, certain times of the year, depending on where you live. Yeah. It makes sense. An enclosed environment wouldn't be perfectly dry.
Mm-hmm. Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, just a simple thing, like with my Chevy van, you get all sorts of condensation and dripping in there. And that's just, you know, given it's not an enclosed spaceship, but even it almost makes it more real to me with such a large ship to have such condensation. It's not like the space shuttle that we have here on reality world that can't have such stuff, but
right. And everything looks like it's used.
Yeah,
it's gritty looking, you know.
It follows that Star Wars vibe of a lived in instead of sanitized.
Sure,
right.
You know, because in fact, when you're talking about never seeing water on a ship before, first thing that came to mind was the Death Star.
I didn't even think about that. Okay.
So while it's a huge and makes, you know, probably much larger than alien ship, but I can't think, what do they call it?
The Nostromo.
Yeah,
the Nostromo.
But still, it would fall into the same basic thing where I'm sure there's parts of the ship that's very sanitary, and then there's,
well, like the computer room where they interface with Mother, the control program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one thing, I'm rabbit hole there. every time I hear them refer to Mother in this movie, I think of Pink Floyd's.
Well, ironically, the blue laser lights when they go into the alien ship, and John Hurt goes in there where the egg room is, that blue laser light was actually donated or borrowed from the band The Who.
Mm-hmm. They were filming. Nice. They were filming a video in Pinewood Studios.
Yeah.
And they said, "Hey, can we borrow this?" Yeah, go ahead. So,
oh man, wouldn't that have been great if you just have like Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend show up in the middle of the Aliens movie?
The one thing this movie does very well is, first, it's very Lovecraftian. It has a very Lovecraft feel to it. But the other thing it does very, very well is it's a sense of claustrophobia.
Yeah.
Especially after Ash comes back, not Ash. Oh my God. John Hurt comes back aboard the ship. Before, the ship felt large, but afterwards, and when you finally see the face hugger, is it just me or does everything seem to shrink a little bit? It seems to like tighten up because you now have this creature roaming around. You don't know where it is.
Yeah, they definitely give you a feel of like, okay, this thing could be anywhere and there is no place for the crew to go to get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So it does get you a little bit claustrophobic.
And the film does a very good job at, through the entire movie, from beginning to end, you have, I guess, almost a sense of dread. Even if the first time you watch it, it's palatable.
Yeah, I can see that.
There's a sense of, and at no point, I guess, from what the cinematographer was saying, at no point does the camera ever stop moving. It is always in motion, even when it's just four people on a screen talking. They either use jump cuts or they pan over slightly, but the camera never stops moving. I guess Ridley Scott wanted to do this to keep the audience uncomfortable. He wanted a sense of motion throughout the entire film. Even when they're checking out the scene behind you, Art, when they're checking out the space jockey, that camera never stops. Like, you know, like when they go up and, you know, in Dallas says, "Oh, it looks like it, whatever this is, came out from the inside." It then does a jump cut to the opposite perspective for the hole. It never stops moving. Just an observation.
Actually, since you brought it up, one thing that always made me wonder with the space jockey, when they're looking at the hole burst out from the inside, I always wondered too, like, well, how do they know? I mean, they made a lot of assumptions on things. How do they know that they don't know what that creature is? They never, you know, in the original film, they never really like name it. Like I mentioned earlier, they don't know what its normal life cycle is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a human giving birth could look equally alien to that creature. We don't, you know, we didn't, when the film came out, they didn't know, at least the characters didn't know, that wasn't that creature's natural life cycle.
Right. I see what you're saying. But you can infer from the events in the film.
Obviously it wasn't, but then again, looking at that creature too, even from a side shot, you can't, like in the old like VHS days and capacitance disc player days, it was really grainy. You know, you couldn't tell that creature wasn't one of those aliens. Or somehow related, like came from the same planet, like an ant comes from our planet.
I see what you're saying. Okay. I've never looked at it like that before. Russ? Thought you were going to say something.
No, I'm just thinking, processing what you guys are talking about. Some mostly just kind of like, because I've watched the movie so many times that it's that I've dare I say I've never thought too deeply about it, you know, and even though I was supposed to be thinking deeper than what I did, I'm just kind of like, there's a lot going on in this movie that, and I'll admit, I haven't watched all the little different movies that came after. I've seen Aliens, of course, and then, but processing what you guys are talking about in the middle of our podcast.
Well, let's say this, Russ. I unfortunately have seen all the sequels and count yourself lucky because some of them are very bad.
I've been trying to catch up on it. The ones that really get me are the Alien and Predator ones, but let's not go there.
Well, I mean, no, even if we touch on it for a minute, I mean, it doesn't hurt to point out that, like, the original films, there were lines that weren't crossed with the aliens. It was like, even in the second one, I mean, they kind of imply that the older kids were taken by the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But Alien versus Predator does kind of, the second one does break some of the rules of the earlier films where a facehugger gets a child, which was kind of shocking. This movie in itself, you don't, as a kid watching it, you don't feel the fear. Your fear at the time is, well, what if this happened to my parents? Okay, you don't, it doesn't like occur to you as a child, like, what would happen if a facehugger gets me?
Mm-hmm.
Or an alien comes after me, because we didn't see that. You know, so there, it was like, yes, it was a horror movie. Yes, it was Lovecraftian, but there were still boundaries and some, like, safeguards almost.
Sure. Have you guys, speaking of, you mentioned John Carpenter earlier, or no? No.
Well, I mentioned The Thing.
Yeah, something I forgot to bring up here. Dan O'Bannon, one of his first major films, is he worked on a movie called Dark Star with John Carpenter. It was John Carpenter is, or I'm sorry, Dark Star can be considered as the joke version of Alien.
Yeah.
It's almost the exact same story, except the alien is a fucking beach ball. And yeah, if you get a chance, see this movie, because the parallels are crazy. And what's interesting is Dan O'Bannon died of Crohn's disease. And it was when he was doing Dark Star was when he was first diagnosed. So I believe he died in like 93, 94. I'll have to double check that. But anyways, that's not a way I would want to go. But I digress. So go ahead.
Oh, all I was going to say was in most horror films in this era, like even if you looked at Halloween, you actually never saw Michael Myers actually kill a child.
No.
You never saw Freddy actually kill a child.
No.
Or Jason for that matter.
Yep, they're always teenagers.
Right. They're always older. And even with like the TV series War of the Worlds, which came out about the same time as the second Alien movie, you never saw a child get fused with an alien. You know, you never saw the alien invade a child. You saw him invade adults. In fact, in one episode, it actually invades, the aliens invade a grandmother and a child's parents, but you never see a child get taken. And that was one of my problems with the Alien versus Predator movies, was they break that barrier. That, you know, that was like a safety barrier in a sense.
Right. But you can assume, at least based on what Newt says in the second movie, because she's like the only survivor and she survived because she was hiding. So right. You can assume that all the other children were infected as well. They don't show it, but it's there.
Right. But as a kid watching these movies, you didn't think really about that other than...
You kind of related being Newt.
Right. Newt was the only one left, and the special edition hadn't been shown yet, you know, 1986, 87, even the theatrical version really didn't show that town that they Hadley's Hope. It didn't really show that there were a lot of other kids. I mean, she does mention she had a brother, but you've never seen him in the original releases on VHS or Selectivision. So you really, I mean, it doesn't really drive home that, yeah, they took other kids and that she only survived by hiding.
Right. And in the original film, I mean, you just have, what, the 5-6 people trapped on board this one ship.
Right. That are all adults.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the space jockey.
And the cat. Can't forget Jones.
But the thing is that Jones like goes right past the alien, and the alien's like right there at one point in front of Jones, but it doesn't go after the cat.
Well, also there's the iconic scene, but if you blink, you miss it, when Ripley's running for the shuttle and she stopped in her tracks because the alien's on the other side of the wall. She sets Jones down in this cat carrier with a window, and you see from the cat's perspective, the alien face looking at the cat.
Yeah.
And he's even, if I remember correctly, he's even tapping on the window, isn't he?
I don't think so.
I don't remember, but in when he she goes to blow up the ship, comes back, and that's when she grabs the cat again, and the alien's gone. But I completely believe that had Jones not been there, or it not been in the case, I think the alien would have killed it, don't you?
No, only because back then, I mean, it made sense for an alien to infect an adult because of the size. A cat wouldn't have made sense necessarily. It would have seemed like insignificant.
Right, but then again, the aliens themselves couldn't infect. Only the facehuggers could.
Right, but at the toward the end of the movie, we end up seeing Dallas again, and he's basically alien cum splattered to the wall, you know.
Right.
I don't know what do you want to call it, but he's like snot splattered to the wall.
Resin.
And he's begging for Ripley to kill him.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Is he there to be an incubator for a face hugger, or is this the way that the alien eats? Is that it like kind of like holds its food? And because that's one thing that I always get confused. It's like, I understand they have a bunch of them in cocoons and aliens, and it seems like it's supposed to be for incubators for the eggs, but at the same time, what are they eating? Because these things do need to feed. They're alive. So is it a mix? Are they?
Yeah, I think it ate Harry Dean Stanton's character, but the other ones it captured to use as incubators for the facehuggers.
And I guess after the, you know, they get the chest bursts out, they can go back and eat the cadavers.
Yeah.
Well, based on what Ash says, when he's doing the cellular analyzation of the facehugger and even the skin of the other one, do they really need to eat? Because everything he's talking about is inorganic.
Yeah, there was a silicon-based life form.
Right. At no point does he ever say that it needs any type of nourishment.
Or at least, well, it may not need like work. It may not be able to even ingest carbon-based life, or basically what we would refer to as meat.
Yeah, maybe it's, lives off of something else then.
True. And with acid for blood, I think it was just, that was just done as a plot device showing that they can't shoot it. But, man, talk about indigestion. So
yeah, what if all they needed was a bunch of baking soda?
That would be the most anticlimactic ending of any movie ever.
It's kind of like what is it? Signs. Oh, the aliens are killing everybody. Oh, but they're allergic to water.
Water.
Oh, the aliens are attacking. Here, Arm and Hammer, see you today.
When we get to, like I said, when we get towards the end here, you know, everyone's dead. She's trying to get to the shuttle. She gets in the shuttle. And I love how they give you this when she takes off and they blow, the ship blows. They give you this false sense of security. I almost wonder, I mean, how in the hell did she not notice this, you know, 8 foot tall being that's been trying to kill her wedged into the side of, you know, a storage bin in the wall? How did she not see it?
Well, and at some point when she realized it was there, you wonder, like, damn, does she feel dumb for just blowing up the ship and that fucking thing's still alive?
Right.
But even before that, when the alien kills Yaphet Kotto and what's her name?
Lambert.
Yeah, Lambert. I remember reading someplace, and now I can't for the life of me remember where the... It was implied that the alien actually raped her. Even though when you see the alien's tail wrapping around what's implied to be her leg, that's actually Harry Dean Stanton's leg.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it was implied that the alien raped her and then killed her, or she died during the rape.
Well, this whole movie has been implied as, for lack of a better word, reverse rape, I guess. I mean, the face hugger, let's face it, it effectively rapes its victim.
Yeah, oh yeah, straight up throat fucks them.
Right. And then I don't know. I've heard arguments that this whole, it's ridiculous, that this whole movie was written as a response to rape culture, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, not for that time, it wasn't. I mean, looking at it through a modern lens, I guess, but I don't get on board with that. I mean, yeah, it's implied, but it's interesting. I've never heard that before, that
the whole Lambert thing, yeah, if you look at like Giger's work with like even the space jockey, the whole thing, I mean, a lot of his work revolves around the corruption of the flesh.
Correct. Biomechanical.
Yeah, biomechanical and or corruption of the flesh, which is very much a Lovecraftian concept.
Very, very.
So I think it goes out of context really to say that it's, I'm not saying rape by any stretch of the imagination or sodomy or anything like that is good. I'm just saying that if you look through the lens of what this movie is and who was behind it, it really isn't surprising.
Right. It's body horror.
And that's exactly what it is. And that was what really sold the shock value of this film.
Because nothing had been seen like that before.
Right. You know, because here you have John Hurt, a creature bursts out of his chest that looks nothing like him, but it's a silicon-based life form that kind of looks like a snake. And then it grows. I mean, there's actually a moment where Harry Dean Stanton finds the skin that it had shed like a snake. And they even make a comment later that it's his son.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of the infamous chest burster scene, in an interview I saw with Veronica Cartwright, the lore is that no one on the principal cast had no clue what was coming that day. That is incorrect. The scene you see in the movie was actually the third take. Because the first two times they tried, it wouldn't burst through the t-shirt that John Hurt was wearing.
Right, but they did use it though. They did use some of that as so it looked like it was pushing its way through.
Yes. And the other thing that they did that the special effects guys did that they didn't tell the cast is for the third take, they hooked up a shit ton more blood tubes. So if you watch very carefully with Lambert, at one point she yells, "Oh God," she yells that because she is directly in front of one of these tubes and gets blasted with blood. And yeah. by the way, they used actual animal body parts in there.
And blood.
Right. And if you look very closely, she slips on the blood and falls backwards over a bench and then gets back up and keeps going through the scene. But that was left in the film.
Yeah.
Makes it more real.
Right. And I guess John Hurt all day was sitting in essentially a hole in that table. And they gave him as much wine and as many cigarettes as he wanted. So, but yeah, the basic story is, at least as it's told, is that was all done in one take, and the crew didn't know, the cast didn't know. They did, because it was the third take.
Yeah, what they didn't know was what the prop crew, the prop department, had done with the pneumatic body parts.
Correct.
That they had used, but they started to smell under the stage lights. And the same thing had happened when Ash was dissecting the face hugger. They had actually used like oysters and other parts inside that.
Sheep guts. I thought they had used guts.
That's just nasty.
Yeah. That you actually see in there is from the oysters.
And Veronica Cartwright said when it was so bad that by the third take, that room stunk to high heaven. They said it took the better part of 2-3 days to ventilate that entire set. So because guys were like retching, it was so bad when they would walk in near the room. But that there is probably... the entire movie rests on that scene. If they could not pull that off in a realistic way, the movie wouldn't work.
No, because it had to be violent and the reactions had to be genuine. And that was really the only way to do it.
And it had to look believable. The alien bursting out had to look believable. Otherwise you weren't going to take this seriously going forward.
Yep.
So do you remember the first time you saw, or what was your reaction the first time you saw the chest burst scene?
Yeah, I was looking at my younger sister for vomiting.
See, I loved it. I was a kid. I'm like, oh, I want one. Not to come out of me. It's like, I want one of those.
Well, they're kind of cute. You know, it's a tiny little alien, you know. I mean, look at the end of Spaceballs, man, when they're at the diner.
Not again. Hello, my darling. Hello.
But the, like you said, nothing like that had ever been seen before in movies prior. I guess you could say Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but not like that.
Yeah, not the original one, certainly.
Even the one from, what was it, 78? The one with, what's his name?
Donald Sutherland. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember that. Actually, I think what grossed me out more than watching that thing burst out of his head was listening to John Hurt like gag right before he flips over the table, you know, because he starts like gagging on his food. That, for some reason, as a kid, grossed me out more than watching this thing break forth from its chest.
Yeah, it's... the gagging is like after that thing comes out, it's like, oh, he's not sick. He just has an alien.
That's why. And it's totally off subject, but someone had brought this up and I thought it was interesting. Right before the dinner scene, they're about ready to go back into cryo sleep, right? And is like, hey, let's get some food. And then Dallas brings up the point, dinner's on me. So someone brought up an interesting, I read a comment somewhere. Did the crew have to pay for their own food?
I think it was implied that he was going to make the dinner.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, but I mean, I could see if they're having to hypersleep or go into suspended animation, having limited quantities of food, and the less they use, the more profitable their trip is.
Right.
So I don't think necessarily that they pay for their own food, but I think it was more of an implication that he was going to cook.
Okay.
You know, and one thing that disappointed me about that whole scene was that nobody offered John Hurt to do the Heimlich maneuver. Not that it would have been good, but it would have been awesome to see like Lambert try to do the Heimlich maneuver on him and have it like burst through her hands.
So wrong.
You know, like completely rip her hands apart.
It's like when Parker says, come on, the food ain't that bad.
Yeah. So, you know, they pat him on the back a few times, but nobody, I mean, this is the future. You can't tell me they don't know the Heimlich maneuver by this time.
Although it's very realistic because you watch someone choking in real life. Most people just sit there and watch. Hey, he's dying. And then finally, as they turn blue, someone runs over like, okay, after they pass out. Oh, maybe we should have done something.
Now, what do you think? I've heard the argument, especially in this documentary I watched, that the movie itself is, if you take the alien out of the equation, it is based on class. You have the officers and flight crew, and you have the repair guys and deck workers. And the argument for this is Parker and what's his name? Not Brian. What the hell is his name? Brett. They're always arguing about their shares. And the argument is that this shows inequality and class in the classes, how the officers are better off than the rest of the crew. I think it's a ridiculous argument because they knew what they were getting into when they signed up.
Right. And even Dallas points out, you'll get whatever's coming to you based on your contract or what you signed the contract or contractually, you'll get what you signed for.
Right. And then even Ripley says, you know, by law, you get a share.
Right. I don't really see that as class. I mean, like if you hired and fired people, run your own business, you pay people. It's not a class system. It's you pay people based on their education and experience or what the job entails. Like if you have a union job, certain jobs pay more because you have to have more training or carry a license for different things. That's not based on class. That's based on like in the military, you get hazardous duty pay depending on your job.
Right. Combat pay, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's not a class thing. That's your job is hazardous. We're going to pay you more for that. Or you have to have so many licenses in order to work on a fire alarm system, so we're going to pay you accordingly to maintain those licenses. And those are just examples. You know, you're not running the heavy loaders or lifters or mining equipment. You're not piloting the ship. If you're in the military and you're a pilot, you're an officer. You know, in the aircraft or in the Navy, your pay is different because you have to have a different education.
Correct. I mean,
and I don't see that as a class system in life. That has nothing to do with color or race or gender.
Right. Well, the argument is, do you remember the scene where it's the first time we see all four of them and they're Parker sitting on the right, you got Tom Skerritt's originally sitting next to him. Then on the left, you have Brett and Ripley. And then what's her name? Lambert comes in and says, well, you know, when they find out where they are, it's like, you know, it's going to take us 10 months to get home. And then Tom Skerritt gets up and stands next to Lambert. You know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The documentary I watched used this scene as an example to show the inequality of the class system. That the stuff on the table is literally a wall in between the workers, the worker class, and the officer class. I thought it was utterly ridiculous. They're just sitting in a common area in the, they're sitting in the dining room.
But, yeah, I don't follow that. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's like, I mean, they all eat at the same table.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at one point, Yaphet Kotto walks into there and point or says something to Ash, you know, you're in my seat, and Ash gets up and moves.
Right.
Clearly, Ash is an officer. He's the science officer and apparently the medic on board.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that whole class thing, I mean, it's kind of bullshit because I've never seen an enlisted person be able to walk up to an officer and say, you're in my spot.
Me neither. And I will grant this. There's one little snippet that they bring up that I can never pronounce his name right. Yaphet Kotto, right?
Yeah.
He says something that's so profound, but everyone ignores him. When they first get John Hurt back on board the ship, and they're all looking at him through the window of the sick bay or whatever, the infirmary, he says, why don't we just freeze him?
Yeah.
And we can look at him when we get home. It makes total sense.
Yes,
it does. Their entire problem would have been solved had they just done that.
assuming that the alien's metabolism would have actually frozen, allowed it to freeze and not continue to grow and then burst out of his chest.
True. And we have seen that it can sustain the vacuum of space.
Right.
Because it was trying to claw its way back into the shuttle when she blows him out the airlock.
Right. No point did the initial face hugger need the same atmosphere as us. Because it's not like the face huggers on the alien ship, on the space jockey ship, they weren't wearing special, you know, spacesuits or anything.
Right. That's why I'm assuming it doesn't need oxygen to breathe or it can survive in zero G.
So, and that's actually why I brought up, there's nothing that says that its metabolism, if it was a real creature, would have gone into suspended animation using the same methods that it takes to put us as humans into suspended animation. Again, if that was even technologically a possibility, but in the movie it is.
Right.
And we just rabbit holed really bad, but no. Yeah, he totally had a good point though.
Or at least contain it. So yeah. It can't, you know, and you know, lock it up. So lock it up. Maybe, I don't know. You would assume any type of a ship like that would probably have some type of a brig just in case.
Or you would assume a vessel that size might have a quarantine room.
Right. And well, Ripley even says you broke quarantine protocol.
Right.
So why don't they just lock him in there, supply him with food?
Yeah.
Enough. And well, depending on, well, 10 months, he wouldn't have died on the trip home. He would have gone crazy from boredom.
Well, and where would he have shit?
Well, quarantine facilities, you got to assume they have, because if they're quarantining for X amount of days, they're going to have facilities.
So what you're saying is that they did absolutely nothing to flatten the curve.
Correct.
Russ, what do you
I'm here.
Russ, what do you think?
I'm sorry. I have
people
that have shown up here, and I haven't been able to listen. Or
that's okay.
And I'm.
What do you think? Should they, if freezing it wasn't an option, do you think they should have just quarantined him?
Oh yeah, sorry, Russ.
You mean the
John Hurt, when he's first infected, the Yaphet Kotto says one of the most profound things ever. He's like, why don't we just freeze him? But they don't, and you see the end result of that. Granted, had the alien been able to be frozen.
Yeah, I think they, you know, quarantine him, definitely, or if they couldn't freeze him, quarantine him.
Or at least they could have, you know, given him enough food, locked him up in quarantine for the rest of the journey.
Yeah.
And then
the only thing is, if the, you know, obviously because he's been infected, if he was in, man, this background thing is really stupid. If he were to be locked up in quarantine, now, of course, they don't know anything that's going to happen with the alien or his acid blood, but would it have been able to figure out if it was, you know, because obviously he was infected and the, you know, the alien would have come out if he wasn't frozen. So if he was in quarantine, how good would that have done? Because the alien would probably know to use its own blood to get through any locks.
True. Very true. Or he could have just brute forced his way through.
Yeah. Depending on the room that they locked him in. Mm-hmm. So it's like, even if they froze him, would that, you know, like you said, because being acid blood and everything, we don't know the temperature, if it survived. Like, did it freeze in space too after it was launched out at the end, or did it just kind of float around alive until someone else, you know?
Well, they burned that. She burned the fuck out of it when.
Oh yeah, the thrusters. She
fired the thrusters. So, but anyhow, let's wrap this. So, final thoughts on the movie itself. First of all, where do we rate it? How do we rate this movie? You know, one being garbage, 10 being the best movie ever made.
I would. Oh, you want to go first, Art?
Go ahead.
I would probably give it. At one point, I probably would have given it like a 9, just because it was, you know, unique. But now, it has become mildly dated. I would still give it an 8, 7.5, 8. I really enjoy it. I still enjoy watching it, but I do feel that the more you watch it, the less it loses its magic. I mean, it's with anything, and it's one of those things where I have used this before, where you can watch a movie and it's really good. And then you can watch a movie that has a really good part that you can watch that part over and over again.
Right.
And this movie doesn't really have any parts that you can watch over and over again. It's just kind of like you can watch the whole thing over and over again, but there's not any one part that just gives you that, woo, I want to watch. It's kind of like an all or nothing movie. So you have to watch the whole thing. So I'd still give it 7.5, 8 now.
Okay. Art?
I would definitely give it an 8, 8.5. Yeah, it's one of those movies. I can't even tell you how many times I've seen it. I've watched it so many times. I mean, I don't rate it as high as the Trinity movies or anywhere near as low as the Treat Williams of movies, you know, fucking Top Gun. But, you know, and it's not like, you know, and even on that scale, there's, you know, Parker Posey and Bruce Davidson. And Parker Posey's the female Treat Williams, but this is definitely a movie I would watch over and over again. And I definitely recommend it to anybody that hasn't seen it, at least to see it once.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because of, but you can't watch it through today's lenses. Really, it's one of those movies where you kind of had to see it back in the day, because you can't. It's one of those movies like a lot of them that we do, that you really can't judge it based on today's moralities or thought processes. You know, I mean, the whole you've got to kind of know what it is you're looking at and understand like where Giger was going with his art and the body, the corruption of the flesh. You know, it's interesting to watch now as an adult. And it was, I thought, awesome as a kid, just because of the special effects. Mm-hmm. One thing I wish they'd gone into more was the damn space jockey. I'd always wished that they would have done a prequel that had better delved into what that was, not recently, but back shortly after, you know, even if they did it after Aliens, but not like what they did with the current one, with like Alien Covenant and Prometheus.
Right. I'm right up there with you. I will rate this a solid 8. You can't view this movie through a modern lens. You just can't. But it did establish the space horror genre, because without this, we would never get like Event Horizon, for example.
Yeah.
And it was a horror movie set in space, and that had never been done before. But I definitely judge this as a watch. Unfortunately, I have to wrap this. Any final thoughts, guys, before we wrap this up?
No, other than I do want to do a quick shout out to Paul at Lowe's. He helped me out pretty good this week with a project I'm working on. And I did promise him I'd give him a shout out. Please hit like and subscribe. And to both of our viewers, we fucking love you guys.
Yeah, and definitely hit us up at our Facebook page and email address. If there's anything you want to see us review or do, please do so. And thank you, everyone. We'll see you on the next one.